This is Chapter a Day. I'm Susan Sweeney. We're reading from Edge of the Map, The Mountain Life of Christine Boskov. The author is Joanna Garten. The book's Wisconsin connection? Christine Feld Boskov grew up in Appleton. By the year 2000, Chris Boskov's reputation had grown by leaps and bounds. Recognized as one of the world's top female alpinists, she summited four of the world's highest mountains by this point and is preparing to scale her fifth, the iconic Mount Everest. She owns Mountain Madness, Seattle's famous expedition company, and she's become that rarity in the high-altitude mountaineering world, a woman leading pretty much all male expeditions. She's also coming to grips with the suicide of her husband Keith 18 months earlier. Edge of the Map, Chapter 5. Sipping soft drinks, passengers aboard a 747 peeked out the window, a vision of vastness, clouds mixed with empty skies. At a cruising altitude of 35,000 feet, the very thought of being on the other side of the jet's thick steel walls seemed absurd. Yet just outside and a mere 7,000 feet below, this height was Chris's playground. Her body wasn't naturally bred for altitude, which made the scenes on the mountains she climbed all the more unbelievable. I remember being with her on Cho Oyu, one of her climbing colleagues said, and the clients were a mess that high, but she looked perfectly normal, like she was out for a stroll, and when she hung out at camp, she was entirely focused on breaking out the high-end cheese and crackers. What was happening to Chris's clients while she ate cheese and crackers was common. Chris's response was a little more unusual. Although the percentage of oxygen in the air at higher altitudes remains the same 21% it is at sea level, the weight of air, the barometric pressure, decreases the higher a person ascends. Less pressure means that the air itself is less concentrated, so not as much oxygen is taken in with each breath. Less oxygen makes it harder for the body to perform work and think clearly. When ascending too high, too fast, some individuals experience high-altitude illnesses. The most common is acute mountain sickness, or AMS, in which appetite may disappear. Those affected may also experience nausea, poor sleeping patterns, fatigue, or difficulty thinking clearly. A nasty headache is the most common symptom. If these symptoms are ignored, or those affected continue to climb higher, two less common but more serious illnesses may occur: high-altitude pulmonary edema, or HAPE, and high-altitude cerebral edema, or HACE. HAPE, the more common of the two, is associated with edema fluid accumulating in the lungs, leaving climbers with increasing difficulty supplying the body with vital oxygen. In the case of HACE, the edema fluid accumulates in the brain, resulting in impaired thinking and behavior, loss of stability in walking, and eventual loss of consciousness. The question as to what it is that allows humans like Chris to acclimatize more easily than others has fascinated scientists for generations. Is it the ability to adapt that is influenced more by genetic components or by environmental factors? The answer at present seems to be that it could be a little of both, with ongoing genetic research leading to new attempts to explain why some people do better than others at altitude. In Chris's case, fitness also played into the equation. Endless climbs of Mount Rainier had no doubt prepared her body well. Keith had schooled her in the proper methods of strengthening her lungs and heart with long runs carrying a heavy pack. With each successive trip higher, Chris's ability to adapt improved. 18 months after Keith died, Chris was at the apex of her career. She had climbed four 8,000-meter peaks. Her business was flourishing. Public interest in mountaineering was at an all-time high. The time seemed perfect to turn her sights to the world's highest mountain. build the Everest Millennium Expedition, the marketing material from Mountain Madness requesting sponsor dollars spoke for itself. At 8,848 meters high, Mount Everest is the highest mountain in the world. Christine has chosen the pre-monsoon season to make history. Please join us to make possible Christine Feld-Boskov's bid to become the only woman in North America to summit 5 8,000-meter peaks. To counteract the effects of extreme altitude, ascents above a certain level typically require supplemental oxygen. This precious gas fills aluminum cylinders and is often carried by Sherpas and other high-altitude workers whose job it is to monitor clients on large expeditions. Oxygen, or O's, are sometimes administered at an altitude predetermined by expedition leaders and at other times on an as-needed basis. While the vast majority of expedition members on 8,000-meter peaks happily use supplemental oxygen, the story differs among elite climbers. Many climbers see the absence of bottled oxygen as a more pure way of attaining a summit. Others argue that climbing without oxygen is preferable to reduce the number of empty bottles discarded by climbers in an attempt to lighten their loads. Whatever the viewpoint, the topic has been debated since 1978, when Mount Everest was first summited without oxygen by European mountaineers Reinhold Messner and Peter Habeler, a feat that had been previously thought unattainable. 22 years later, Peter Habeler wanted to try again, with Chris as his partner. "She invited me, and I was so happy to meet Everest again after such a long time," he recalled. "I had heard about Chris and knew she was an incredible strong climber, but I came to also find her warm and respectful." The Austrian climber had maintained his conditioning over many decades. Now 58, he felt confident he could summit again without supplemental oxygen. When he heard Chris was ready to attempt Everest, he grabbed the opportunity. His climbs with Messner in the 70s and 80s had been in the alpine style, carrying light loads, spending minimal time on the mountain. Peter had always felt that a quicker ascent was the safer way to go. The Mountain Madness Everest team in 2000 consisted of a small number of like-minded climbers. Chris wouldn't be leading clients, but rather attempting her own first ascent on Everest. This would allow her to climb more rapidly, instead of tending to others. They were one of 14 teams attempting the summit that year, and the permit issued by Nepal's Ministry of Tourism and Civil Aviation listed the name of Mountain Madness team leader as Mr. Christine Boskov. Also joining Peter and Chris would be Nazir Sabir, a friend of Scott Fisher. Nazir was meant to be on Scott's fateful 1996 expedition before pulling out due to schedule conflicts. A renowned mountaineer from Pakistan, Nazir had attempted Everest once before in 1997. If he reached the top this time, he'd be the first Pakistani to do so. Kili Sherpa would also be on Everest. As planned, he'd helped Mountain Madness dig deeper into the Nepal market, stepping up to fill part of the void left when Chris lost Keith. Having been to the base of Everest many times, Kili himself was still looking for a summit. He'd been high, but never to the top of the world. He hoped the year 2000 with Chris, Nazir, and Peter would be it. Outside their tent, the winds had picked up again. Kili and Chris lay in their sleeping bags, wondering if it was time to descend. The two had made it to Camp 4 on the south call of Everest in early May 2000. Nazir and several team members were in other tents, all of them feeling the force of the 68-mile-an-hour winds. This last section before the summit was notorious for wind. Already, this season had been marked with similar winds that had forced many climbers to seek safety in lower camps. Up to this point in the climb, Chris and Peter had been formidable partners, Her strength and ability to adapt at high altitude challenged him. Keeping pace with each other on training rotations, traversing the Khumbu Icefall, the two got through it in 45 minutes, while most other climbers needed 3 hours. Though Chris was still on the rise, Peter's celebrity had caused a stir at base camp. A friend recalled just how his presence had played out. Chris told me that at one point on the expedition, a couple climbers came up to the two of them, all unrecognizably bundled up, and asked excitedly about whether they'd heard that legendary Peter Hobbler was on the mountain. Chris loved it, and so did he. He played it up with her, standing right next to him, saying, "Oh my gosh, you're kidding, Peter Hobbler? Really?" And then he kept it going, and he said, "Hey, you know you should ask her, because she hangs out with the big boys." He pointed to Chris, who laughed, shook her head, and said she'd be on the lookout. According to this friend, Chris's assumption was that these climbers would never have guessed Peter was standing right in front of them, because, after all, who could imagine he would climb with a woman? They probably assumed he was a guide and she was a client. Years later, Chris's humor was perhaps one of the most compelling attributes that Peter remembered. "Something I really value in mountaineers is a sense of humor," he said. "She had a wonderful sense of humor, and I just loved that and thought it was so important. You simply had to like her, if not to love her." The duo stuck together for weeks on Everest, coaxing each other through winds and snow that hadn't been seen at that level in years. After his first two attempts at the summit failed because of weather, Peter began to feel the effects of altitude. His lungs rattled, a sure sign of hape. Any ambition of ascending Everest a second time without oxygen was dashed. He went down to a lower camp, eventually giving up his summit bid, and reporting that an old man should not try to climb Everest without oxygen. Meanwhile, Chris and Killy rested in their tent at Camp 4. They'd entered the death zone and were unable to sleep. The wind threatened to blow them off the slopes. A lone cylinder nestled between them, its regulator adjusted to allow a constant flow of precious oxygen. Tubing stretched to a mask, cupping Killy's mouth and nose. He turned his head to look at Chris. Her breathing was slow and mouth uncovered. She'd refused oxygen, hoping to be the first American woman to summit Everest without it. Killy paused, not accustomed to giving advice to the woman he respected so greatly. His memory of first meeting Keith and Chris at Gokyo Lake felt bittersweet without Keith here now. Killy had been a steady force since Keith died, and Chris in turn had carved a path for Killy to a new life. If there were anyone he'd give his life for, it was Chris. He removed his mask, allowing words to be exchanged. "Chris, you should use oxygen. We're at South Col. You need it now." "I don't want it. Even if I did, I don't have a tank." Killy nodded, pulling his mask off and holding it out to her. Her blue eyes looked tired, her voice weak. The space between them felt strained by the disagreement. "Yes, I know. You can use mine. If you're beaten up by altitude, it's a big problem here. Even myself, strong Sherpa, I get very tired." She balked at the idea. "I really wanted to do this without O's, Killy. I did. Peter did, too." "You have come to climb Everest, Chris. You are strong, stronger than me. But if you get sick..." Killy couldn't begin to think about her falling ill on his watch. They stared at each other, neither budging until Chris spoke.
"Just to get through the night?"
"Yes, just that."
She reached for the mask in silence as Killy adjusted the dial on the regulator. Placing it over her mouth and nose, she inhaled, closing her eyes. Oxygen poured into her body, precious and life-sustaining. As she drew in three more breaths, her body softened into the sleeping bag. She removed the mask and handed it to Killy, who took three breaths of his own. Taking turns with the mask, the two gradually fell into hypoxic sleep. On the morning of May 24th, Chris reached the summit of Everest, her fifth 8,000-meter peak. The moment was fleeting. It was her fourth attempt at the summit in just a few weeks, and she was without Killy, who decided that 2000 was not his year. After several attempts, thwarted by wind, he departed, returning to base camp, leaving Chris to pursue the summit with one remaining altitude guide and more bottled oxygen. The only picture of Chris on that morning shows her kneeling on the summit, her ice axe wedged into a thick wave of snow at her thighs. Grasping the base of her oxygen mask with a gloved hand, she's wrapped in a black and bright red hooded down suit. The mask shrouds most of her face, the rest covered with goggles. It's impossible to see a smile, a moment of elation or pride. Before descending, she placed a call to Joyce from a satellite phone telling her, "Mom, I'm on top of the world!" The call was brief, shortened by Chris's knowledge that the trip down would be just as perilous as the ascent. Asked later by journalists what she thought about at the top, Chris said, "Well, first I felt relieved because we'd been there so long. It was the first time I'd thought of going home. I also thought a lot about Scott Fisher, and I was hoping he was proud of his company. You think about the people that have helped you, who are there rooting for you. Then you think of going down to get some tea. You know you're only halfway there when you get to the top. You still have to focus to get down safely and live to tell about it." The descent from Everest exemplified Chris's strength and spirit. What often takes a couple of days took her just 9 hours. Passing through Camp 4, she refused to rest and continued down to base camp. Nazir Sabir became the first Pakistani on top of Everest a week before Chris. Though she was not with him at the time, Mountain Madness received credit for his success, with the Pakistani press reporting that his expedition had been led by American lady Christine Feld-Boskoff. The year 2000 also marked the year the first Nepali woman reached the top of the mountain. In June, Chris returned home to Seattle. Friends wrapped her in warmth and praise, though her thoughts were elsewhere. The adrenaline rush of the past 7 years had caught up with her, as she wrote in her journal. "After getting back from Nepal, I had mixed feelings about my future with the business, with climbing, and love. I knew I had serious decisions to make with the state of Mountain Madness. I was also frustrated with where my own personal climbing ambitions were taking me. Disappointed, I ended up using oxygen for my final summit attempt. I was tired of having everyone tell me what my limits were, assuming because I was female, there were certain limits I could not obtain. For example, summiting Everest without oxygen. I wanted advice, but didn't know where to turn." Frustrated and full of self-doubt, Chris penned a final sentence that few mountaineers have ever fathomed writing. "Everest was not a challenge for me." Norwood, Colorado is only a 30-minute drive from Telluride, but a contrast to the ski town in every way. Easing his way onto Charlie Fowler's street just beyond Norwood Center, Keith Brown wondered what he should expect from their dinner date. Charlie had jumped at Brown's offer to pick him up and take him back to his place for a home-cooked meal. Brown knew the conversations were worth the drive there and back. In the short time he'd known Charlie, he'd come to appreciate his authenticity. A meal with Charlie would be without bull, void of self-importance, and perhaps not even touch on the stories and adventures that made him one of the most iconic rock climbers of all time. It would just be dinner with Charlie. Getting him solo and outside the masses of the climbing scene in Telluride was the key to unlocking his charm. Brown parked in front of Charlie's yellow and white cabin, a 1920s two-room structure with a dilapidated roof. The sun had set, bringing the spring temperature down to 30 degrees as he knocked on the door. After a moment, Charlie opened it, his laconic drawl welcoming Brown with, "Hey, cool, come on in." The 550-square-foot home held not much more than a wood stove, prayer flags, climbing books, boxes of gear, and Kodachrome slides. Stepping inside, Brown realized the temperature mirrored the cold outside. "What's up with the heat?" he asked. "Oh, yeah, well, truth be told, I never got around to bringing in wood for the stove this year." "This year? So no heat in this winter?" "Nah, don't need it. A pain with all that wood anyway." Brown felt momentarily stymied, unclear how to respond to something missing that seemed critical in the frigid Colorado winters. Although he longed to return to the warmth of his car, Brown understood the reason for Charlie's absolute comfort in the chill of his own home. Charlie's lean 5'8" frame was packed tightly into a down expedition suit, complete with hood, very likely the same one he'd recently worn climbing in the Himalayas. Weathered by decades of wind and sun, Charlie's face was lined in a way that made it known he was an outdoorsman. His hair, a mess of gray and dark brown, had a perpetually tousled look. Peering from under the hood, Charlie's eyes were clear, inviting. Now in his early 50s, he looked full of life, quite ready for Brown to hand him an ice axe or a thermos of hot tea and point to the nearest crag. "Let's go," Charlie said. "I'm starving." The slight southern accent that Charlie spoke with came from years growing up in Virginia. His father, an Episcopalian minister who died when Charlie was 21, spent two decades teaching his son to hike and camp in the nearby Smoky Mountains. From his librarian mother, Charlie learned to seek fulfillment outside social norms. Calling his mom a left-winger with heavy Marxist leanings in her, Charlie had a lifelong advocate. Nurturing his love of the outdoors and his disdain for the establishment, Charlie's mother watched him race through a degree in environmental science in 3 years at the University of Virginia. On the day of his last final in 1975, he packed his car with climbing gear and moved to Boulder, Colorado. Hooked on the sport of climbing already, he'd led several classic climbs up in New York and West Virginia. For the next several decades, Charlie focused on cutting a trail for himself that combined work he enjoyed with his love of climbing. Among his job titles were furniture maker, writer, bag designer, computer programmer, and trip leader. Each position was designed to add value to his lifestyle while allowing the greatest amount of time for climbing. The sewing work eventually led him to make backpacks, patch clothing, and to add pockets to simple lawn chairs that he'd sleep on during camping trips. By the mid-1980s, Charlie had become known for his first ascents. In the Tetons, the Wind River Range, Canyonlands, Red Rocks, and Yosemite. In his 30s, he began traveling outside the United States to Patagonia, Bhutan, Nepal, and Tibet. Following his trips, Charlie put together slideshows to share in Telluride, sometimes at private homes, sometimes at pizza joints. The visuals were astounding. Charlie exploring remote communist China in the early 1990s, Charlie bumping along dusty roads in the Peruvian countryside, Charlie's tent staked to dry brush in rural Nepal. Each journey seemed unencumbered, as if nothing else in the world mattered but the moment at hand. Even in times of seeming distress, his outlook resonated positivity. In one memorable 1984 experience, Charlie teamed up with boulder climber Alex Lowe for a winter ascent of the Diamond, a vertical to overhanging 1,000-foot wall that started at 13,000 feet on the east face of Long's Peak in Colorado. To begin, the pair dodged an avalanche, an event that would have caused many other climbers to hightail it to safety. For Alex and Charlie, it was simply a sign that the coast was clear. With snow falling, thick layers accumulated against the flat rock as the two ascended unroped. Then, without warning, a wind slab broke from under Alex's feet, hitting Charlie square on and sending him falling over the cliffs and down the smooth rock face. Charlie later described that fall. "As I began to free fall, I thought, this is really going to hurt. Much to my surprise, I landed softly in a sitting position in a huge pile of new fallen snow. It didn't hurt that much at all. No one seemed too surprised by our story, but by then I already had a reputation for an uncanny ability to cheat death." Unlike other climbers who sought partners with equal or greater ability, Charlie never shied from the chance to be on rock with beginners, nor did he seek the glory of mastering popular routes or the money that called to him from big sponsors. His sweet spot was discovering challenging, unexplored places that could push his limits and increase his skill set, regardless of who he climbed with. In a sport that could be ego-driven, Charlie sought only to pass on his enthusiasm. Our book is Edge of the Map, a nonfiction book by Joanna Garten, published in 2020 by Mountaineers Books. The music is Distant Green Valley, played by Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble. I'm Susan Sweeney. We'll read more from the book next time on Chapter a Day.